This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Mimi and I had a rare opportunity to sit down with one of the most widely read writers in the world, Isabel Allende, on the occasion of the paperback release of her bestseller, Island Beneath the Sea. Allende talks about her novel, which evokes historical events that rock the late 18th century. She also discusses the blood-chilling and heartbreaking story that connects the links between the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the revolt of the Haitian slaves led by Toussaint Louverture, the sale of Louisiana to the U.S., and the rising influence of the abolition movement.
Allende juxtaposes slave rebellion and the quest for self-determination of past decades with the continuing reality of various nations' imperialist designs and the still catastrophic results for the world's peoples. She also addresses her painful recollections of the death of her cousin, Chile's socialist president, Salvador Allende, who died in a coup engineered by General Augusto Pinochet, leading to years of fascist rule, which deeply influenced the core of her writings. Similarly, her desire for the exhumation of Salvador Allende to determine the exact manner of his death, as are her writings, are a quest for historic reclamation and social rectification. Now we speak with Isabel Allende. One of the things that I must say in reading this book, I have always considered Isabel Allende a conjurer. Somehow you immerse yourself in the history and what must have been the nature of the characters that are part of this historic construct, and you bring them to life. It's not like creating a flat character, but you really conjure up spirits. I've always found that as part of your writing, which is thoroughly engrossing to me and a bit frightening as well, that you have that capability.
Thank you. When I write a story, I show up in front of the computer and try to, well, if I show up long enough and with patience, I sort of feel the characters. They come alive. I think that the story has happened before, or it's happening right now, or will happen, but it doesn't belong to me. I have to just be the medium through which the characters will tell me their lives. And people are, you know, very similar all over the world, so it's very easy for me to put myself in the place of Sarité, the slave, because she wasn't different from me. She felt the same things I feel. Her emotions, her feelings, her body was like mine.
I'm wondering if it's not presumptuous to think that part of what is in your blood, in your background, that enables you to do that is really the history and your family's history in Chile, the nature of both promise and expectation and liberation, and similarly fascism and repression as exercised under the Pinochet regime. Is that part of what informs your spirit and enables you to write this story of Haiti, of slavery, to create this nexus from Haiti to us?
It's interesting what you were saying. I had never thought of it, but the person I am has been shaped by my experience in Chile. I was a young woman in Chile, mother of two kids, when Salvador Allende was elected president. He was the first socialist Marxist president ever elected in a democratic election, and the world was watching. The time of the Cold War, the United States would never allow another Cuban revolution in Latin America. So they sabotaged the Chilean regime, and eventually they provoked a military coup that created a very brutal military dictatorship headed by Augusto Pinochet that lasted 17 years. I had to get out with my family. The brutality of what happened in Chile marked my life, and of course marked, I think, my writing. It made me a writer. I would not be a writer if I had stayed in Chile. I became a writer because I was living in exile, and I needed to save my memory from oblivion and to recover the world I had lost. That was the intention of The House of the Spirit, my first novel. So probably you are right that everything that I have lived makes me more open to understand what may have happened in Haiti 200 years ago.
And of course you talk about the brutality of Haiti 200 years ago, and your main character is Zara Tay. If you could talk a bit about her in the book and also how she changed in your mind as you were writing the book.
When I started the book, I knew that I was going to tell the story from the perspective of a woman, and I knew she was going to be a slave. But I had not, the first couple of weeks, I was stuck because I had all the information that I had researched for 4 years, but I didn't have my character. And then one night, I don't know if I was asleep or half asleep, I saw her. I saw this African woman, very tall, with a long neck and long hands and slanted eyes, very short hair. And she came with a name. She was called Sarite. So I knew it was her. I knew I had found her, and I could tell her story with her voice. I could even hear her deep voice in my ear. So it wasn't difficult once I had her to write about her. And I'm convinced that she existed because as I was writing, I could feel her more and more present, real. And I could feel her struggle and her pain and her love. And there's a moment in the book, the story is about this girl who is born into slavery. She's the daughter of an African slave that was raped by the sailors in the ship in the middle path. And as it usually happened, they raped them because if they got pregnant, they would be more valuable in the slave market. And so this baby is born who is of mixed race, and this is Sarite. The mother commits suicide, and the girl eventually is sold to a plantation owner, who is not a bad guy, considering the times. If we judge him today, of course, he's the villain. But then he was considered a very humanitarian and enlightened slave owner, French. And he considered himself a very good master. And so Sarite becomes his slave and his mistress. And he has children by him, and what happens to the children is pretty awful. But the conditions of the slaves in the plantation and in Haiti in general were terrible. The life expectancy of a young slave in a sugar plantation in Haiti was 6 years max. They were exploited to death because it was much cheaper to bring new slaves than to treat them humanely. Sarite is a domestic slave, so she's not in the fields, but she can see what's going on. And so the revolt starts. And why did the revolt, the only slave revolt in history that has succeeded was in Haiti. Why did it succeed? Because the slaves had no choice. It was death or freedom. They fought to death or for freedom, and they won. So the story of Sarite for me is the story that I would have had if I was there, if I had been her, that would have been my life. And it's easy for me to imagine how that can be.
I would say that your prevalence of the drum and the lyrical nature of the human body, the dance throughout, always seems to be the element of liberation, the constant purveyor or allowing the capture of one's culture as one is torn away from Africa to hang in there, to give identity even under the system of being chattel. And I find that just amazing, the way you characterize and paint and give us sound to that drum as the ever-present liberatory factor.
The slaves came from different places in Africa. They were often from different ethnicities and languages and religions. And they were brought like cattle to Haiti, where they were sold. And usually the masters would not buy people that were from the same village, because it was much easier to control them if they did not come from the same place. So often the slaves did not share a language, and they didn't share a religion. But in order to understand what happened with the slave revolt, they connected through the drums. It was the drums, the music, the physical strength of that that connected them. And the other incredible force that united them was voodoo. Voodoo was the combined religion that united them in the belief that their souls would be free in death when they would go to the island beneath the sea, the lost paradise. They had come by sea. They had to return to paradise by sea. That's why they thought that in an island beneath the sea were the souls of the dead waiting. And when the revolt started, it started in a voodoo ceremony, and this is historical. And the empowerment of these people by the practice of their spiritual belief was incredible. They would fall in a trance in the ceremonies and be mounted by the Lords. The Lords were like the intermediaries between the one God only, Papa Bon Dieu, and human beings. And in between were these Lords, like the saints in the Catholic Church. But they would be mounted by them, possessed. And this possession made them superhuman. They could face the cannons of Napoleon, the best trained troops in Europe that had defeated Europe. They could face them naked, with a machete in their hands, in superhuman courage, to the point that the French believed that they were superhuman, that they had some kind of trick that made them so courageous. It's an incredible story. And the other thing that I wanted to point out, let me tell you that today in the world, there are 27 million slaves counted, innumerable more that have not been counted. Never before in history we have had so many slaves. Of course, the population has grown. But there are abolitionist movements today trying to liberate those slaves. I'm not talking only about little slave girls in brothels in Asia. No. We are talking about forced labor. The human trafficking is the third largest illegal industry in the world. The first one being weapons, the second drug, and the third, human trafficking. People are trafficked and enslaved everywhere. There are whole villages, for example, in Pakistan, where the whole village is enslaved because of what they call debt bondage. If you have contracted a debt of any kind and you can't pay, you become a slave, and your children will be slaves, and your grandchildren if you don't pay. Often the men are shackled, and the women and the children work in the fields 18 hours a day, and that's how it is. So, and you say, why don't they revolt? Why is this allowed? Well, why does the world allow it? In theory, we have the laws to prevent it, but it still exists, and it's increasing.
Did the trafficking that you have just explained to us, and that I know that you are deeply immersed in the eradication of, is that what necessitated and informed in many ways and compelled you to begin the writing of this book with a character as stark, as painful, as sturdy in many ways as Zarate, who speaks in her own voice as well as whose story is told as Titi?
I wasn't planning to write about slavery at all. It wasn't my idea. I wanted to write, on the contrary, about the golden era of the free people of color in New Orleans. That was between the 1800 and 1830, when this community had education. The boys were educated often in Europe. The girls went to the Ursuline School, where the white girls went, by the way, separated it was the same education by the same nuns. And they owned land. Many of them owned slaves. This is not very well known, but many free people of color owned plantations and slaves. I thought this is such a rich and wonderful time when everything got started, the culture, the cuisine, the music, the blues, the jazz, everything had its seed at that time. And I wanted to write about that, but then I realized that the French flavor of New Orleans came from 10,000 refugees that landed there in 1800, running away from the revolution in Haiti, which was then called Saint-Domingue. And they were running away. And I said, why did these people come? So I started researching, and I realized that they were the white French colonizers that would have been killed if they had stayed. So they ran away with their families, and often with their domestic slaves and their families of color, because they had African concubines or mistresses that they brought with them. And many of them ended up being part of that community of free people of color in Louisiana.
I'm interested in the psychology of the slave master, Marin, who considers himself to be a civilized man, considers himself to be a kind man, but justifies slavery because he considers the slaves to be subhuman, even though Zarate is his equal in every way, even besting him in cards and running the household. But he can't see that.
Well, today there are millions of people who think that they are enlightened and kind and Christian and charitable and compassionate, and they see poverty all around them, and they don't think that there's anything wrong with it. That's the way the world was made. That's the way the world is. You can't change that. You can treat the people around you nicely, but you don't have to get involved with a big scheme of things. Isn't it the same mentality?
Well, indeed, and so often within the context of this book, I remember one of the lines where you talk about the first wife of the slave master is that she did not notice the presence of her slave, only her absence. And again, there's a besting. Tete Zarate is asked about what her position is to validate that slaves are the proverbial, if you will, three-fifths of a human being intellectually, etc. And when she's asked to validate the position of the slave owner, what her response is, that a being who is not human has no opinion. And the irony and the starkness of that is exactly what you were just saying, which is the ability of people who oppress to both rationalize and dehumanize, because if they didn't dehumanize for the benefit of their privilege, how could they possibly do what they do? And
exactly.
I think that is so captured in this book.
And that's exactly what we do when we go to war. We dehumanize the enemy. The enemy is not human. He's half a person. And the children that are killed and the women that are killed, they are not like us. They're different. They don't suffer as much, isn't it? The way we justify every brutality that we do.
Well, I want to pick up another one of your phrases, really, in the book where you speak about he, however, did not want to sacrifice himself. To him, the war seemed a squandering of resources and lives, the least reasonable way to resolve conflicts. So there's also a reality about the rising up, the slave revolt, but the barbarity in some ways of the resolution of conflict. The conflict itself is an inherent barbarism, but also the nature of war and militarism is critiqued very much in this book.
Of course, because it is madness. You know, I just saw a play in New York, actually, called War Horses. Mm. And in the play is about the First World War. 10 million young men died in that war, and 8 million horses, because there was infantry and cavalry, and we don't ever think of the horses. And the play is about the horses, and the puppets are the most incredible thing. I love the play. But what is obvious in the play is the madness of the concept that you are going to convince anybody of anything by killing them. You're going to make them better or save them by killing them. It's just an extraordinary statement about how crazy is the world we live in.
And certainly the book also, how crazy is the systems that we devise for very often our own self-aggrandizement or a systemic profitability, the system of slavery, its inherent contradictions that almost must eventually implode, are just so graphically depicted that, again, I was totally sucked into the book and felt my blood coursing through my veins with each character's either rationalization or brutality or the various ways that people survived and their own humanity, which I think is superb, the way you've crafted all
Thank
of this.
Thank you. There's a part in the book that was the most difficult for me, because I had been hearing Sarité's voice, her struggle for freedom, how desperately, since she was a child, she had tried to escape and she had tried to be free. There is a point in the book when she has to choose between going with her lover to the mountains with the rebels and leaving behind her children, staying in slavery with her children, and she stayed. I struggled with that for weeks because I thought that it would be such a different book if she goes to the mountains with the lover and if she becomes one of the rebels. But in truth, if I was her, I would have not left the children behind. I would have stayed. And so there were moments in the book in which I really felt her pain and her struggle and her despair.
That's very clear, which is why I really opened by telling you that I think of you as much of as a writer as a conjurer of spirits that you breathe life into. And as you breathe life, you actually become them. Maybe that part of the Vudam also, that it is enmeshed you and you take on the spirits and wrestle with the decisions that you also would have made. And I think that's why the characters are so deep, so profound, so rich. It's an extraordinary, important book. And particularly today, still, the efforts of the Haitian people who have not fully rested themselves despite catastrophe from the elements, but have not rested themselves from still the oppression. And so much of that seems to give an additional resonance to this important book, even though I know it was written before the earthquake and so on.
Yeah, it was a different country then. The island was covered with forest. It was the most fertile land. One third of the income of France came from Haiti. So one has to ask the question, what happened? Why is this one of the poorest countries in the world today? Well, then it was worked by 500,000 slaves, and the land was owned by 20,000 whites. During the war that lasted more than 10 years, the land was devastated. The forests were burned. Now the island has no forest. It's just mountains. And the revolution was betrayed by its own generals, who, in order to support the war, ended up selling the same people that they had liberated. So it's also, there was an economic blockage of Haiti by the European powers and the United States, because they didn't want the idea of a slave revolt to be exported anywhere else. It's been a tragic history for Haiti.
I also can't help but return, since we mentioned Chile and Salvador Allende, there is an exhumation to look at how President Allende died as the fortress that he was in to secure himself, hopefully, which was not to be the case, from the onslaught of the Pinochet coup. I'm interested in your feelings about the political significance of that exhumation and what it is we learn from the actuality of how President Allende physically died in any event, because spiritually, for many of us, the spirit of Chile and of what he tried to bring to Chile is so very vibrant still.
Salvador Allende died in the presidential palace, a very old adobe building that has been the center of government in Chile since the beginning of the republic. He was there with some of his followers during the day of the coup, and the palace was bombed by the Air Force, and part of it was destroyed, and there was a huge fire. Then when the palace was surrounded by the military, Allende asked all the people that were inside to surrender and to leave in a line, orderly, and leave the palace. And he would be the last one to go. He stayed behind, and then they found his body. Nobody was ever sure if he killed himself or if he was assassinated. There are all kinds of theories. One says that he was killed by the military, and they tried to make it appear as a suicide. Other people say that it was suicide because he would never, ever surrender. He would not be a prisoner of the military. And other people say that he had Cuban bodyguards, and the bodyguards killed him because they wanted Allende to be a hero, not a prisoner. So there are all these theories and many more. And the body was taken out of the presidential palace in flames and buried in a place that was not marked. All the family left the country, the ones who were not arrested or killed, left, and most of them ended up in Mexico. Many, many years later, after the end of the dictatorship, Salvador Allende's widow, Tencha Allende, and her daughter Isabel came back to Chile. The body was seen once when it was transferred from this temporary tomb where it had been to the family tomb. But it was not really studied. They just saw the body. So they know that he was in that place. It was him, but they never studied it. So now, because of all this historical controversy, it's time to know what really happened. And that's the reason why it's being exhumated, with the consent of his direct family.
I'm wondering if you ever thought about writing a novel about contemporary United States or another part of the world, and what kind of ideas you might express in such a novel.
I just wrote another novel published in Spanish that is about the United States. It's a contemporary novel that happens in 2009 to an American girl who is 19 years old and she's from Berkeley. It's not a political book, but it is a book in which I reflect a lot of what I've been seeing in my grandchildren. The kind of world they are living in and the kind of values that they have. That's what the book is about. And the girl gets in deep trouble and ends up in a very backward rural island in the south of Chile, in Chiloé, in some archipelago very deep in the south. So it's a contrast between these two worlds, and it is also a time for the girl to go into a journey inside herself and grow up. I had fun writing it.
Well, all your work.
All that research.
What's the title of it?
In English, it's going to be called Maya's Notebook. Maya is the name of the girl.
We'll
I thought I was going to have to sharpen my skills in Spanish to read that. I've read all of your work, and I insist that you are a conjurer, and that all your
work is
deeply spiritual and deeply political, including the one that you've just described, because you always contextualize your characters. They live in the world with all of its problems and dissatisfactions, and the choices that they make create a thinking for us that I so appreciate. That's why I say I very often fight with your characters. They do make me think about myself as much as anything
else.
You will
fight with Maya, because when I was writing it, I just wanted to pull her ears. I was so angry at her. I was furious.
I appreciate that. I am really glad that you spent some time with us today.
Your
writing is so important for me as a woman, because your characters are always such dimensional women. Whatever perspectives or situations they find themselves in, they are very, very multidimensional. And thank you for being you and the issues that you engage in through your writing and through the way you live your life and realize your political commitment to a far more just world.
Thank you so much for giving me the chance to be in your program.
It was totally our pleasure, and we have been speaking to Isabel Allende about her novel, Island Beneath the Sea, an absolute must read, as is all of her work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.